This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Derek Newton. He's a writer. He's written a lot about education and fraud and AI. I think that is a poor summary, but at least covers the high points. And we're going to talk today about AI and how it affects the publishing and publishing industry and writers in general. How are you, Derek?
I am very good. I thought your introduction was fantastic. I appreciate being here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming on. It's hard to find anybody who's not thinking about AI right now. I think it comes up in pretty much every aspect of our lives today. Publishers in particular, I think, are kind of living out a, might want to say double-edged sword kind of existence with AI. I know that a lot of publishers are trying to figure it out. How can it be used effectively and meaningfully? A lot of writers are extremely reticent and concerned about the future in an AI environment. It reminds me a little bit, and I know I don't want to do all the talking here, but this feels a little bit like a time in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when there was a revolt against industrialism and the rise of the arts and crafts movement. And I just wonder if that's, you know, if you agree, we're kind of in this interesting inflection point where things are very much not clear, but there's a lot going on.
I do agree. I think everything you said is absolutely right. There is a ton going on. I don't think anybody really has the definitive answer for, like, this is what we should all do. I think there's a lot of questions still out there, important things to think about, and partly because the technology keeps changing and it's changing quickly, and that changes what you thought yesterday and how you're going to approach it tomorrow. And I also agree, I really like that you brought up a wider lens. I haven't thought of an example, I haven't thought of an exception to this, where a technology has come into being and there wasn't, you know, mass adoption. You could do the printing press, you could do the steam engine, you could do any sort of revolutionary technology. And it hasn't also opened up a lane for the sort of more handmade, old way of doing things, that these things didn't go away. They actually went up tremendously in value. There were fewer of them. But, you know, furniture is a great example. You know, furniture is now widely available and super, super cheap by any standard in history. But handmade artisan woodcraft furniture, still around, still, you know, now much more expensive than it was before a lot of the machining came into place. And you could just go through every sort of step of technology and find that it does change everything, but it also opens up a lane for sort of authentic traditional craft and sort of rewards people who still do that. So I think your vision on that is absolutely right, that it isn't, I don't necessarily see it as a rebellion, but seeing it as an appreciation for effort and craft and artisanness, if I could give that word. And I'm hopeful that we're going to see that again. I think AI is going to change a lot of things, but I don't suspect it's going to do away with human writing and human storytelling.
No, I agree with that. I think that what you've said is true, that every technological advance has reduced a certain level of generalized contact and increased a narrower opportunity. But that, and I've also heard and read people saying, writing persuasively, that AI will increase the value of the human creation because the robotic, we'll call it, or machine-made creations are of plainly lesser value, perhaps higher utility, but lesser value. And so you have this kind of interesting conundrum, because, as you said, it opens up a lane, but it's a fairly narrow lane in general. You know, there aren't that many practitioners. So there are going to be, you'll have a bifurcation. Some people will say, I am going to be a craft artisan, a practitioner of the art to the greatest degree and extent that I can. And you'll have other people saying, I'm going to go mass market.
Yeah.
I'm going to go for the broadest, least common denominator, lower cost. It's sort of like mass market paperbacks in the 50s and 60s emerging as a low cost manufacturing methodology that allowed masses of people to read books at low cost.
Yeah.
And there was I'm pretty sure there was a lot of resistance to that by the traditional publishers, thinking that it would cheapen the book. Mm-hmm. And then the argument on the other side is, we got more readers. And how can that be bad? So now the comparison may not be perfect, because AI is such a radical technology. It's so disruptive and changing so much so quickly that we don't even know what the effects will be. So it's hard to be sure that the comparison to anything that we've seen in the past, even if it's, you know, even if we think that everything changes, but everything remains the same. Principles are, of human behavior are always the same.
Sure.
But this is a really, I think, perceptibly a really radical technology that is altering human behavior, as you said before, so quickly. And it is itself iterative and therefore changing faster than, and the other thing is the people who created it don't even understand how it works.
Right. That's always reassuring. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen the technology. Like, we knew how, when mass market books were created, the people that made those presses, they knew exactly how they worked.
Oh yeah. And they knew exactly who their product was aimed for, you know, who they were creating it for. You know, they knew the market they were trying to create. I mean, yeah, they had definite clarity of those things. And it's a good contrast. I'm not so sure the developers, producers, sellers of this new technology know any of that.
So knowing that the technology is here, you know, no matter, it doesn't really matter whether I say, you say, or publishers or writers say, it's complicated, it's problematical, and we don't know how it's going to work out. It's still going to happen. We're not in charge of this. We're here to figure out how can we, maybe we being the book industry writers, how do we grapple with it? Some people have decided to just ignore it, you know, which is a legitimate response. And other people have tried to experiment and play, you know, and learn. Mm-hmm. And other people are trying to master it. And I think, at least in the publishing business, I don't think we have yet seen fully how it will affect us. But, you know, maybe you should talk a little bit about how this intersects with your writing in the past. You've written about primarily about fraud and misinformation. And I think it is a really interesting connection point between that and AI, because there is so much opportunity for fraud and misinformation with a technology that is so proficient.
Yeah, thank you. There is a big crossover, I think, in the work that I've done, the research, the writing, the reporting, with intentional deception. I guess that's just an umbrella term, right? Like people who are trying to deceive because they want to get a good grade in a college course, or they want to get their academic paper published in a respectable journal, or they want to give a good speech. And so they, you know, take the words of other people without giving credit to the original author. You know, they want some sort of reward for themselves without having done the work. And then they obviously attempt to deceive people about whose work it really is and where it actually came from. This is a subject I've been working on for 10 or 12 years. And AI has just really accelerated that conversation, because the content creation is now so fast and so inexpensive in terms of time and labor and cost, relative cost. And it is occasionally very good. It's clever and can produce reasonably good work very quickly and efficiently. And this is incentivized people who are looking for reward without the labor to use this tool for that purpose. And so, you know, this may not be the question you asked directly, but I'm sort of really agnostic about AI as a writing tool. I don't have a strong philosophical approach to it being good or bad or helpful or not helpful. Where I do sort of, you know, build up a defense and pick out the hill that I'm willing to die on is that the people people should know whether it was AI or whether it was human written. If you used AI to edit, if you used AI to write and then you edited, that sort of disclosure and transparency ought to be expected and required, I think, in this landscape. And then let readers, let the market decide, let publishers decide if this is the material they want to publish because they know the audience maybe prefers AI. They know the audience, the readers don't care. You know, let the audience decide, the market decide, and let publishers decide. But we should have really clear standards and really clear conversations about what is in the content we're discussing, whether it's something you're reading or whether it's something you're considering publishing or whether it's a speech you're considering. We should just really insist on transparency and disclosure around those points.
So let me ask you a clarifying question, maybe. Let's supposing, and this is where I think first layer is, and you mentioned publishers want to know whether the work they're receiving to consider to publish is human written, assisted, or whatever. Here's a use case that I can think of immediately. I write a novel. I ingest it into one of the many AI engines, and I don't let it ingest into one that's going to steal it, but use it. You know, I have my own. I keep it on private. And I ask for it to write me a top-level summary of my novel with a marketing-oriented bent so that a potential publisher might understand my novel and why they would want to publish it. That's going to be an AI summary of my book. Do I send that to the publisher I'm trying to get an agent maybe. Do I send the cover letter and say, I had AI write the cover letter, but I wrote this book 100% by myself. And I think that AI can do a better job of summarizing and selling my novel than I can because I'm too close to it. And I think that that would be a legitimate use case for an author. And I think a publisher might actually appreciate it.
100%. And that's what I would, you know, nobody has to listen to me, but that's what I would do. And that's what I would encourage people to do. If generative AI wrote a summary or a pitch, for example, I don't think there's any harm in that. And I would just say, tell people, right? Like exactly what you said, this is the pitch that ChatGPT or Claude or any engines wrote. You know, here's what I asked it to write. And I liked it. I think it's fairly objective, but here, this is where this came from and this is what it is. And then the novel, you know, I didn't use AI. And that's, you know, we haven't gotten to it yet, but that's my background in writing and in covering deception and fraud. And the reason I'm here is because I've started a company to help authors do that called Verify My Writing. And what we do is we take exactly what you said, take your manuscript or your novel or your pitch, and you could come to our website, get it scanned and get a certification, a credential that you can then share with publishers or agents, as you said, that says, yeah, this has been checked. It's human written. I got 100% or I got a 99.7, whatever that score is. And then the agents, transparency, right? The agents, the publishers know, okay, the manuscript, 99.9. Love it. Great. I don't have this question anymore. But the summary, the marketing summary, sure. You know, the publishers, I've been speaking to many, many publishers, dozens over the past maybe 6-8 weeks. You know, they're sort of agnostic about marketing summaries or pitches. You know, they're inclined to use AI to write those as well. No problem. But they do have questions and concerns about the underlying work.
Well, although to be fair, I think if you're going to say that the author's legitimate writing has to be 99.9% human, when you take that marketing pitch And then you send it to Amazon and all the rest of the retailers because it did a better job at writing the pitch. And maybe it's not going to be 100% machine written, you know, because professional copywriters might use it as a tool to be more efficient, but they're not going to use it to replace themselves. That's not
going to happen. I wouldn't think so. Yeah.
We would hope that that would happen. But so it, then you have another, I mean, it's sort of like, is there any hypocrisy there? Because we're saying the text has to be human written, but the marketing material, oh, who cares about that? Let that be, AI assisted, let's say. One could make an argument that that is a level of deception that is, and even if you, and I'm not sure what, how the readers or Amazon, I have no idea, if you put a disclaimer at the end of the product page in the book, in the metadata saying, we certify this novel as 100% written by humans, but we can't say that about the text you just read trying to pitch you and get you to buy the book. That was 65% human and 35% AI. I don't know what people would think of that.
I don't either. It's a difficult question as you presented it. I agree. That's one of the solutions we're providing with my new company is exactly what you described, a reader facing badge, a designation, a seal, if you will, that says that this particular news article or this particular book has been checked and it's verified to have been human written.
Maybe 8 or 9 months ago, I had the same idea. I thought it would be a really good thing to do. I mean, ideas are cheap. Like I didn't do it, but you did. But I think, and you're not alone. I think there are several entities who want to offer the same service. I think it is highly valuable, and I could imagine it being useful not just for writers and for publishers, but in other venues as well. You know, I mean, for a magazine looking, you know, publishing articles, which you mentioned earlier on, how a form of deception is people wanting to be published in an academic journal. And there have been instances of, you know, scientific studies cited that don't exist, whether that's LLM generated or human generated fake, it's still a fake. So the certification, I think, is really important. Now, when you do this, though, are you able to fact check or are you, in other words, let's say in the course of writing my novel, I write a nonfiction book. Usually publishers, as part of copy editing, there's a degree of fact checking done. Now, there's a big argument whether how much fact checking do publishers really do, but copy editors, if they're doing a thorough job, will fact check. And I've been part of conversations between copy editors and authors where the copy editor says, you know, you referred to this happening in 1912 and no, it happened in 1874. And you're going to have to rewrite a whole section of your book around that because the supposition is 50 years off. I am assuming, well, I'm asking, I guess I shouldn't assume, can your verification process also do fact checking, or is that a separate process altogether?
It's a separate process. Technologies exist to help with that. I think they're still new and evolving, so I don't think they're as powerful as we want them to be yet. I think they'll get there, and they can assist the fact checker in their process, but they're not, as my knowledge, they're not yet good enough to sort of take the lead on that process. And I think they will get there. I want to back up though half a second. There, as far as I know, we're the only provider that actually scans the work and gives a score. There are two or three that I'm aware of that will give you a badge if you promise you didn't use AI. That's a checkbox and an affirmation. And again, my work on intentional deception tells me that's not very helpful. So, you know, we went to the step of actually examining it and scoring.
Are you mainly working with authors or with publishers or both?
Both. Our service is author facing. So authors, writers like me, put in our work to get the score. And the fee is based on the word count. If it's a long form journalism piece like I usually do, it's $10. You know, it's not, maybe for many people, $10 is prohibitive, but also for many people, it's not. And it goes up from there. And that way you get a certification, you get a downloadable certificate that you can send in. You know, years and years ago, I wrote a few screenplays and I banged my head against the wall like everyone else trying to get agents to read my stuff and, you know, meet with me and take me on. Never succeeded at that. But in that process, I learned a lot, right? It was the experience of saying, man, if I could get their attention somehow, and that's a service I'm trying to provide now to writers, to attach that sort of on the cover or with it some, you know, we have an embeddable icon that says, hey, you know, now, especially in this environment, please pay attention to me. I wrote, you know, this is human written. I'm trying to be honest. I'm coming to you as a craft practitioner of writing and asking for your attention for my work. And the publishers and editors and agents I've spoken with, I think really appreciate that. And I think that's going to be even more common more quickly because they're getting their submissions have tripled, quintupled. They're flooded and really ill positioned to address this onslaught of submissions that they're getting. Because they're
I've heard that, and I've heard that also in the context of literary magazines, where and there you know in this country around the world there are thousands of literary magazines, almost all of which are not profit making entities. In fact, I would say the 99.9% of literary magazines are there for the love of writing, and even though they have to, you know, exist in a commercial environment. If you are a literary magazine, when you have triple the number of submissions, that alone could put you out of business because your time is all voluntary for that kind of reading. And I know that it's a huge problem. And clearly the eruption of submissions is tied to the newfound ease with which people can write whatever it is they're writing.
That's right.
Now, I don't know. I have not heard anything about AI written poetry. I don't think it's, you know, it's probably not the commercial way. No, very few people think of poetry as a commercial endeavor. So it's unlikely
right.
that you have a lot of commercial intent there. But okay. as you alluded, I mean, you've sort of touched on this. A lot of people write because they want recognition. And even though poetry may not make you money, getting published for writing poetry is a form of recognition that people want.
And it is absolutely.
I can imagine and this sort of goes to the plagiarism element of this conversation. And that is, you know, a lot of editors have learned to be on they can see a plagiarized poem pretty readily. You know, I used to teach poetry in the schools, and you know, it's pretty easy to tell when a kid had gone to the library and found William Carlos Williams or somebody like that, and you know, gives you back their stuff, thinking somehow that you'll never notice. But I would imagine, not only in poetry, but in fiction and nonfiction, it's just overwhelming.
Yeah, it has to be. I haven't investigated that thoroughly, but I think you're right. Logic tells me that that's absolutely the case. The difficulty.
Well, it could be very helpful to literary magazines to have they may not be able to buy your service because they have no money, but they could promote it to potential submitters.
Right. Yeah. And that's, to be clear, that's sort of what I think is one of the hidden beauties of our model, what we're trying to do, because we don't sell to publishers or magazines, that we don't have a product that they can buy. For them, it's free because we're asking the authors to bear the burden and the cost of getting their work certified. So in a literary magazine case is a perfect example, right? They're volunteer readers, you know, they're not profit making engines, but we can work with them. If they just start telling their submitters, hey, please go get this certification, then two things I think will happen. And we're seeing this already. They'll get fewer submissions because people who, you know, used AI think they're going to get caught, and they probably will be, and they just won't bother, right? There's no upside for them in paying the $10 to get a certification that says, yeah, it's 80% AI. They just don't bother to go through the process, so they don't submit. So we can cut down on their submissions, and we can give them a lot of comfort that what they do publish is human written, which I think for them has real value. And I just want to say on this point too, it isn't just that publishers, you know, are old school and are thinking that they like human storytelling, or that they think their audiences don't want AI. Both of those things may be true, but there are some very significant legal issues with publishing AI produced content. The most significant now is that you can't copyright them.
That's right.
So it can't be protected. So if you're a publisher, especially a high-end publisher, who's going to pay the writer a nice fee that they deserve, who's going to spend the money to get the book actually published, who's going to hire marketing people, who's going to send the author to book fairs, who's going to push it in their publicity and invest hundreds of thousands of dollars to make these books sell, it's just bad business if you can't protect the IP. If you wake up a year later and that book doesn't belong to you and it doesn't belong to the author either, you spent $500,000 on something that you can no longer profit from. It's not a business that can function without intellectual property protection. And so publishers are really getting hurt here because their submissions are up. They are struggling to filter through them. They're not trained in AI detection technology. They don't want to be trained. This is not, you know, nobody got into publishing to, you know, to play robot police. That just wasn't something that they said, oh, please, that's my dream job. And they're having to then bear an expense, right, to pay for these AI detection systems, to have staff run the submissions through, to understand what the scores mean, to then email the writer and say, well, you got a 62, that's not good enough. You know, this whole extra world of work that wasn't there 3 years ago is making their lives really, really difficult. Even if you set aside the legal thing, which is catastrophically dangerous for them, they are just in a world that they never asked to be in and need a way out. And so our reception with publishers and agents has been very, very, very good because they see this as a way to say, oh, wait, I can only get stuff that's already been checked by someone else. Yeah, let me do that.
Right. And what I would imagine the evolution of that is to say, as a publisher, I won't read anything unless it's been vetted through, it doesn't have to be yours, but vetted by some acceptable form of technology that tells me it's not written substantially by AI. And now each publisher will have to decide. And I assume when you give a score, you know, if I don't know what a publisher would say if it's 89% written by human, 11% verified by as, you know, machine. I'm not sure where that goes because, as you mentioned, the copyright issue, I don't think that there is any statement from the Library of Congress saying 88% is okay. I think it's, it's
there's
human
no guidance on that. Yeah, there's no guidance on that at all. You're right. And I say also, well, I do hope they use ours. And this is, I'll just spend 10 seconds on this. There are a lot of AI detection systems on the market. If you just Google AI detection, you'll get 100 different companies selling you this service. And they're all over the map in terms of their quality, in terms of how rigorous they are. Some of them way over flagged and give bad results. Some of them way under flagged. And so that's another thing I'm trying to accomplish is get some consistency in this market, a common language, a common score, so that everybody knows what a 90 is. A 90 from one detector is not necessarily a 90 in another. That isn't sustainable for long term either in a market with a lot of money and a lot of work involved. People need to be measuring You know, you can't have one person measuring in yards and the other one in meters for very long, despite the fact that we've done it for 250 years, 300 years. But you get where I'm going. There, in order for it to function well, there has to be some standardization. Mm-hmm. And I'm completely off topic. I forgot what you even asked, but I've lost the train of thought.
The question sort of was an imaginary one, whether a publisher would decide that an 89% score okay,
100%.
But that's up to them. That's not, you know, you don't really care about that in a way.
Exactly. The bad analogy that I've been using, and it's not great, but it works, is that, you know, we function like the credit bureau, right? We give a credit score, and it's up to you if you're going to, you know, give the mortgage or not. I can't tell you what your credit score should be for your lending policy. You know that. You have to set that. And I do suspect that it's going to be different. You know, if you're publishing in a genre that publishes a lot of titles very often, and they tend to heat up quickly, sell, and then fade, you know, maybe a 75 or an 80 is good enough for you. The IP concerns aren't long-term, probably, right? But if you're publishing in an area where you expect it to be bought for the next 10 years, 15 years, maybe it has a potential to spin up a movie franchise. You know, maybe there's going to be multiple series in this book with lovable characters that define a generation. The IP then becomes a whole lot more important. And so I just think it's going to depend not only on the publisher, but on in what genre they're aiming at, who they think the reader market is. Because we haven't seen a lot of research on this yet. There's been some, but not a lot. We don't, and this goes back to our conversation at the start, we don't really have a good handle at all on what the market wants or expects in AI content. We just have no idea. Right.
No, we don't. But we won't, even if you did know today, you wouldn't know what that meant for tomorrow or the next day or next year.
That's 100% right.
You know, and I think as human beings, we have to question what will the impact be on culture if it's possible for machine-made culture to exist side by side and effectively so with human-made culture. And we can say, you know, the higher and better will be the human and the utility-driven will be the machine-made, but we don't know. We really don't know.
No, we don't know. And it may be a long time before we sort that out. You know, people are surprised when I say this, machines, language models, call them machines, they're software, have been writing sports stories in newspapers and magazines for going on 20 years now. No one noticed. They could take a box score from a baseball game,
right,
and write the 10-paragraph description of the game, and it was published in your paper if you wanted to read what happened in the game last night. For almost 20 years, that's been machine written. People weren't writing those summaries. They haven't been for a long time. I suspect, this is just my gut, having covered it, that maybe it doesn't matter if AI or a large language model writes the earnings report for a major corporation. It's basically data that is written narratively with charts and a lot of facts. And we're probably okay with that. You know, I might watch a sci-fi movie that was half written by AI because it's escapism, and I'm not looking to, you know, be enriched in that way. But there are other things that I'm going, if I'm going to read someone's memoir, I really sort of have an expectation that it's from them. Right. So I think my gut tells me that this is going to filter out in some ways. There are going to be some things where we have a very high bar for human work and authenticity and voices. That's really the premium that I'm willing to spend my money on and my attention to invest in what is out there. And other things where I almost might prefer an AI generated thing because it's going to have consistency and it's going to have utility that isn't worth a higher investment, frankly.
Well, it sort of goes,
I could be wrong.
What we were saying before, that the summary, the marketing summary could be machine written and you would not mind it because it's a utility use of the technology, but the novel itself, you want to be 100% original. It's sort of, Another variant of that is we already know that AI can read x-rays and other tests in medicine and see things that humans fail to notice. It can actually help doctors in doing analysis of what they often they're looking at every day, but they didn't quite see this really little detail that the machine is actually built to see. So it could be similarly, there are uses of the AI in creative culture that could be viewed ultimately as beneficial because it will do things that a human couldn't do as readily. But we do want to, I think right now we don't know what that may look like.
Yeah.
We also don't know if it turns out that AI creates a sort of flattening effect. After a while, people will get tired of that, consuming what appears to be the same version of reality over and over again. They're going to want something different. So this could be like everything else. It could go from one extreme to another.
Yep.
We tend to do that as human beings. So
we do. We do. That wouldn't surprise me either. You know, that they, and that's sort of what I was alluding to earlier, you know, as that happens, and it's another bad example, but you know, IKEA is the example that comes to mind. I was talking about furniture, right? IKEA is a flattening effect as you described it, right? It has compressed that much more available, much cheaper, but eventually people say, okay, I want something different, and they go out and seek it. And there's usually a price premium for that. And it's funny, your made up example of the summary being AI produced while the underlying manuscript was human written actually came up maybe a week or 10 days ago now, where an author submitted through our system and got a score of like, I can't remember exactly what it was, something in the mid 90s, and was not protesting that, but it was saying, I don't understand. I wrote this. When he submitted the work, had the, you know, I guess two and a half page summary on the front of it, like as an introduction sort of overview, and the system caught it.
Right.
And we just had a very quick conversation, like that summary there. He said, no, I had AI do that. I said, well, that's what it was. So we took it out, you know, or just, you know, pulled it out and then submitted the thing without that marketing summary. And it was 99.7. But that's exactly what happened. He submitted one with the marketing summary, the overview in it, and it brought the score down. So, you know, we just need to pay attention to those things. And I think they're not that you thought it was far fetched, but your example was very real.
Well, I think it will be interesting. We should probably have another conversation about this a couple of years from now and see where it has gone. You may have a completely different view of things, or maybe an evolved view of things by then.
Sure.
But I do think that this is really interesting. And I think that you're onto something important, which is to be able to validate what we write. It will have extreme value as time goes on. So
I hope so. And I think so. And I appreciate you saying so.
So we'll be watching to see how this evolves together. I want to thank you, Derek, for being on the show. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. And I've been talking to Derek Newton. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave. Glad to be here.